You're listening to the Gold Squadron Podcast, your home for X-Wing discussion, strategy, and entertainment.
Welcome to episode 45 of the Gold Squadron Podcast. I am your host, Dio Morales, and I am joined by the Average Joe.
Who's that?
You.
Oh, yeah.
Nate Moore. Nate Moore, call sign Chatter. Live. Ron Longy, gold leader.
A very sleepy gold leader.
And our targeting coordinator, Andrea Longy.
Hey guys, how are you?
She still has no voice.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. So our plan today is I had an interview with Patrick, one of the members of our community, and talk a little bit more in depth about pace of play. And we're also going to be covering what happened at our Chicago Regional. Actually, I need to ask you a question before we start. do you want to use your last name? Do you want to just be Patrick?
Yeah, what
do you want
to do? Patrick, because my last name is hard as hell to pronounce. It's Boyajian, but most people are just like, how do you spell that? It's okay. B-O-Y. Right, okay. Da, da, da.
Yep. All right. All right, everybody. So we have a treat here today. If you guys remember a couple months back, I had introduced the pace of play research that I had done. And after that, one of the awesome members of our community, known as Patrick on a lot of the forums and on Facebook, reached out and said, "Hey, I really like what you did. And you said it would be cool if somebody went in and got more in depth and started looking at game breakdowns per turn, and it would take a lot of work." And he did it. So Patrick, how you doing, man?
I'm doing fabulous. Thank you for having me, Dion.
So before we started officially recording, we said that we were probably both gluttons for punishment for doing all this, huh?
Absolutely. It's a passion.
So, I maybe you could say laid the groundwork for this and then you ran with it. The floor is yours. I'll kind of ask questions, but you can kind of go through what you did. I will link your document in the show notes so that people can look at it. Mm-hmm. And we can start to see how our information maybe matched each other and maybe where there were some differences or where you went more in depth.
Yeah. So basically the new rule of 11, the 11 turns, was a great base or foundation, because with that, you're able to compare with what I did with strictly dial times, because I did want to go into like what you wanted, actions, movement, bumping, and try to measure those. But honestly, that it's nearly impossible. So I strictly did dial times. And the reason I did that is because there's nothing in the game that affects you when you pick up your dial and go to set it. So I know there's, things like Intel Agent, but that happens after you set your dial. So it's very easy just to watch a game, watch people pick up their dials, set them, put them down. The way that I tracked the dial times to where when you pick up your dials and, there is the cleanup stage, so there's a few seconds in between those settings. When you set your dial and put them down, let's say that's 60 seconds for all of your dials, whether it's two dials or five dials, then your opponent also has his time clock running. So he's also setting his dials. He puts them down, let's say, after 90 seconds. But within that 30-second gap that you have, you picked up your dial at, say, 75 seconds. You reset it to something else, put it back down. I then had the decision to say, okay, do I just make that 3 seconds or do I give him the whole 75 seconds? So I decided to give him the whole 75 seconds instead of that little adjustment that he made. Only because I have no idea what that person's thinking. I don't know what they're doing in between. That's time that they were using while their opponent was also deciding their dials. And then from there, you just tracked each turn. I was tracking in when they engaged, when their first ship, and also when their second ship was destroyed. I did track other ships, but I just wanted to know the first and second ship being destroyed. After that, I totaled their dial time. I divided just like you did with the sections for the first three turns, and I averaged those dial times. Then I did instead of you, I think, did 4 to 7 turns for the next gap.
Mm-hmm.
I did. Yeah. I did 4 to 9. Only because with your 11 turns, usually 4 to 9 was when most of the action would happen. And then 10 and 11 was cleanup. And then after, you know, turn 10 and on, I just averaged all those dial times together. And I came to one of the same conclusions that you did, to where it goes up and then it comes back down for your play time. That's, you know, that encompasses like to where you're not engaged. You're just kind of getting your setup ready to where you're going to engage. And then engagement happens, and then after that, you start to lose ships, you start to lose dials, and then, therefore, your game time starts to get kind of a faster pace of play, and then either goes to time, or all your ships are destroyed. So then, I just started pooling the data together, and I was able to come up with a lot of interesting information.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear that that our information correlated, that, you know, that when somebody else took a look at the data as well, that we started seeing, hey, some of the trends that I viewed was repeatable. So it's starting to show that there actually was a trend there.
Exactly. And then the only part that wasn't fun to track was, I know that you were able to go through, I think, like 80 or 100 games.
Yeah.
So yeah, I stopped at 50 only because I'm tracking 2 dials per game. So that's technically exactly 100 dials. And then also a lot of previous not podcasters, but streamers, they've edited it to where there's no dial time. You just see them cut out. So I was able to watch a lot of the games that you probably watched. But then there were ones, the older ones like Covenant that used to cover worlds and stuff like that. I couldn't use any of their information. I'd love to. If they would be able to send me a full video, I'd love to add those dial times so I can get, the earlier years in there. I think the oldest one I have was like 2015. So I also tracked that as well, like you did. I tracked the times, and also the number of dials. So I even divided those up, 2 dials, 3 dials, 4 dials, averages, and then also the total average for everything.
Yeah, some people had asked me why don't I edit out dial times? And the reason I've always given is I think understanding the pace of the game is important, which is why I leave it in.
Oh, and God bless you for doing that, because after, I think, 40 matches, it got really hard to find matches to where there was still dial time included. And
yep, well, I have about, what is it? I have 6, 12... 13, 14, 15, 16. I have 17 more matches uploading for you right now. So.
Yeah, I was already watching them. And I'm going to practice against one of the lists that were on the stream, because I thought it was very interesting and I need to prepare for it for when I go to regionals. And the other thing was, if I started watching a match and it would cut out or I would lose some of the feed, I didn't include that at all. I immediately stopped recording that and I'd go to some next match.
Right, because you didn't have the full data of the game, and the whole point of your research and observation was viewing the changing trends across the game.
Exactly. I didn't want anything left out or anything left to chance. And so I'll give you some quick bullet points, but I mean, if you could, I would just have you air horn over them because they literally don't matter. And this is only because previous podcasts, including yourself, have talked about, you know, things that they would like to include, or at least ideas that they'd like to include, comparing to total dial time someone should have for the match, or limiting dial times to, you know, 1.5 minutes per turn or something like that. So some of the numbers that I have are your total dial average. That's all the matches I've watched, compounded into one average, which was 828 seconds, which averages out, I do the quick math, which I should have done this before, but you know, what are you gonna do?
820, it's all right,
divided by 60, it's 13 minutes. So the only reason this number doesn't matter is because, as you say, the average is 11. However, the size of turns that happen, all the way from, I think the lowest I had was 5, and then the highest, like you had, was like 26. So that average, I mean, you could do standard deviation, but it's way too much wide of a gap to have this number mean anything. Because you could say, oh, my match only went 6 seconds. I had 828 seconds for my dials. I'm fine. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So, and the same thing if my match was 26 turns. Oh, my average was 828 seconds. And it's like, how did you get that many turns? And that's insane. And it's the same thing with dial average per turn, which is 77 seconds. Again, that number is meaningless because when you first set up your ships, your dial time's like either zero, because you've set up your dials before the game even started or the clock timer, or you're now engaged with one another and you need extra time. And so you're going to have either zero or you're going to have like 5 minutes be your dial time. So 77 means literally nothing. And then I've also, and I can I can show you, Excel actually has a standard deviation equation that you can just enter in and it does it all for you. So I did that as well, because I have the average per turn and then the standard deviation for each of those turns. And it is kind of a big range, but it's within a very acceptable high low. So, you know, the average, let's say for turn five, is 117 seconds. And then the standard deviation for that is 76 seconds above and below. So, you know, you're talking roughly 117 divided by 60. Oh, I think I did that wrong. Look at that. Yeah, divided by 60. Yeah, you're talking 2 minutes. And then you add another minute above and below. So with that, it means that the standard, which you came up with as well, the standard engagement is turn three, which you start low with your dials, and then there's a peak at turn five. And, you know, not to give you such graces, but you should have it. I call it the Dion Plateau. I honestly, it was really eerie, and it makes sense, but with your peak, I think, was around the same turn time. It was, I think, turn six, you saw the longest turn times or something like that. Yeah. And so this is the same thing with dial times. So if you can see the graph, if you look up online when Dion posts it, you really start very low at dial one. And then by turn five, that's where the peak happens, to where that's your longest time that you're going to spend setting your dial. That's just on the average. And then after that, it comes down just a smidge till turn seven. And then after that, it almost just goes down to below 50 seconds average with a standard deviation of like 40 seconds. So I'll first tell you what this eliminates to help. Because I did ask on Facebook, hey, what are some examples you guys give me a slow play? And if you possibly saw it on stream, let me know. What they mostly posted was somebody taking 5 minutes per dial per turn. So that immediately eliminates right. that as an option for somebody to play and say, nope, you're slow playing. Your dial time should not be consistent. You should go rise up, hit that plateau. It should start coming down after that. With your engagement, it's going to vary that plateau. So if you engage turn two, your plateau is going to hit sooner. If you engage turn six, your plateau is going to hit later, and then it's going to start coming down again. I know I could keep rambling on about this forever, but...
That's all right. You go ahead.
I know. So after that, I immediately started looking for what causes this. Because anytime you have these spikes, you really want to know, why are these spikes happening? So I thought it was the engagement turn, if that caused it. It didn't. What really caused it was when a ship would basically be removed from the board, which was really eerie, because at turn five, that's when your first plateau happens. And then the average time a ship would die would turn your first ship, that's for either person, was turn six. And then when I first started doing this, I saw a second plateau at turn eight or nine. It's now at turn seven, but your average second death is about turn nine. So that's why you see that huge plateau. Those are the people taking the extra time they need to make sure their ship either gets maybe another shot, is about to die. So they're just taking that extra time to maybe make it live or coming up with another strategy. And then after that, that's when ships start to go away. And so your dial times come down. And then on top of that, people usually know when it's over. And then their dials start to slow down as well, because they're just setting them quick, and then that's it. It's over.
Right. And then, you know, yeah, to talk about, you know, that extra plateau when it comes to around turn 8 or 9, the first one you said, when the first ship dies, yep, around 5 or 6, the reason that happens is you have to reevaluate now. You know, you came in with a strategy, assuming all your ships were alive. You just lost one. You have to reestablish your strategy. And that's the reason why things are going to slow down, because you now have to form a new plan of attack. You have to figure out, all right, what vectors do I need to come from now? Or even just, we're human, right? You have become emotionally shaken. Mm-hmm. My ship is dead. I didn't want it to die. Crap, you need a second to recover, and then you jump back in.
Exactly. So, I mean, once that started coming in, I was able to like start refining more. So if you have only two dials, and when you break it down, it makes more sense. When you have two ships, they're really kitted out to be able to survive, to output damage, and have maximum maneuverability. Of course, that, like, a prime example is Jump Masters and even Asajj. So if you're playing two dials, your games usually go longer, which I found. The average game time was 12 if you have two dials. Your first death was around turn 6 or 7, and your second death was around turn 11, which I found interesting. Also, your dial time peaks were a little bit different, but they still peaked at the same spot. And by that, I mean, so I actually have a chart to where it shows the average of all dials, and the two kind of falls right below that. However, it still keeps that same pace. So two dials, you're going to do almost the same dial time as if you were doing three dials or four dials, which I know some people won't believe, but it's true. And I know, you know, I didn't really do list constructions to where, okay, this list is able to fly at this speeds and this dial time and so on and so forth. I just did three dials, four dials, and two dials.
Yeah.
And
I mean, because that's something that encompasses all factions and everybody who's playing. And that's understandable. Exactly. I mean, to start breaking it down by individual list archetypes, I mean, that's a whole nother insane step.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I don't really want to do that because it might poison the game. And that's like something I really don't want to tread on.
Because
I mean, I know there are certain people that are like, oh, you're flying this list and you're facing that list. Okay, you have a 40-60 chance. And it's like, well, that's depressing. And I don't want to make it so, okay, well, you're flying this list against this list. You're going to have this. This is going to happen in this turn, and then this is going to happen. Now that's it. I don't want to break it down any more than it needs to be. And then I did three dials. It's around the same time, the 6 and 8 for first and second death ships. The dial times were relatively the same. And then we go to fourth dial averages. It's relatively, again, the same, other than I don't think I had enough really data for four dials in the upcoming months. I probably will, because you're going to see more four ship builds just because of the row boats and quick draw. But again, those average game turns were around 11, and their death times were turn 5 and turn 8. So it's relatively the same for no matter how many dials that you're using, your dial times, as insane as that sounds. But I found an answer for that as well, if you would like me to go into that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so when I started doing the dial times, I really wanted to do where if you set your dials, that's your time, and then if you pick it up and put it down, that's 3 seconds. However, I found out that your dial time correlates to what your opponent's dial time is. So if you are the type of person that holds your dials for 2.5 minutes, sets all of them, and then puts them face down, you have a very consistent dial time. However, if your opponent's the type of person that sets them quick and puts them down, he's noticing that you're taking longer. So they're going to pick it up and look at it and make sure that that's what they want to do. And then they put it back down. Then they pick up the next one. Oh, nope. They change it real quick. Put it back down. So they're also utilizing that dial time, which is why when I started tracking two people in one match, they almost inevitably ended up at the same dial time, which was really interesting to learn.
That makes sense. You start to adjust. And I know at higher levels of play, a couple of just kind of, this is really a mental strategy. If you feel that your opponent is going slow and you are fast, one thing you can do, you can utilize a time during that mid game. When it starts coming down to the wire and you know you need more turns, you get down those dials as quick as possible. And that starts to pressure your opponent into, oh, I need to hurry up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that in some of the higher level games.
Absolutely. And that's another, topic that I would love to cover. I think fast play is more dangerous or I can't think of the word, but it happens more often than slow play. Because when somebody sets their dials down real quick, they're waiting for their opponent to set their dials. And I'm only seeing the table, so I don't see body language and stuff like that, which I think made it easier to track dial times, and there's no bias or outside influence.
Right.
And so, you're kind of trying to pressure them to set their dials down fast as well. And then you can even tell by how they're moving their ships, like, and throwing down templates and tossing their tokens on the board, and you're just like, okay, yeah, we get it.
you want to go fast.
You're chasing Poe with, a ship that really isn't going to catch up to him or kill him quick enough. I get it, but you can't rush your opponent like that.
Right. And so, you've given us a lot of numbers. I know there's the people who love the numbers have just taken that in. They're like, oh, that's really interesting, and they'll be able to look through this. If you could boil this down and maybe give us what do everybody want? Everybody wants to talk about, all right, so what did you, give me like the finite summary of pace of play. Have you come to any conclusions on how to identify slow play? We'll start there.
Yes. So I have determined almost strictly through dials how you can determine slow play, even if you're a judge called over halfway through a game. As long as the players have tracked somewhat of what they have been doing. So when you said it's important that if your game goes to game or turn 11 or beyond, it's basically gravy. I completely agree with that as long as other criteria happen, such as, so if you're called for slow play, from at least my standpoint, my first question is, did your game go to time? Because I know you're going to call a judge over during a match, but a lot of people will claim slow play after a match. So did your game go to time? Has your opponent had a higher dial average or above the standard deviation across the board, or at least on a lot of the turns? Was your engagement later than the turn three? And did your opponent benefit from slow playing? These are excellent questions that your judge should be coming over and asking, or at least being able to visualize when he comes over and looks at the board. So if you're called over, let's say, in the middle of a match, you should ask, okay, when did you first engage? And I already put up an example, turn three. How long has your opponent been taking on their dials? You can say 1 to 2 minutes, but they took 5 minutes last turn. Okay, when did you notice the slow play? Turn five. Okay, what turn is it? It's turn six. And how many ships did your opponent start and how many do they have now? Three, but one has one hull left. Okay, how much time is left in the round? 40 minutes. Are they benefiting from slow play? No. So then you can clearly, you can say, no, they're not slow playing you. This is just how the game goes. Just because they took 5 minutes on their dials last turn does not mean they're slow playing you, unless they start taking 5 minutes consecutively every single turn. If a judge is called over and you say, when did you engage? And it's turn four, or they engage turn four. How long have they been taking their dials? 4 minutes per turn. When did you notice the slow play? Turn six. What turn is it? Turn eight. He has two ships left, but they're at half points. And there's 15 minutes left in the round. Okay. Is slow play beneficial, or is beneficial to him? Absolutely. Okay. I can now make a clear case that he's slow playing you. Whether or not, you know, he's moving his ships fast enough, his dials are speaking that he's playing slowly.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. So just having knowledge of how the flow of the game is supposed to go can help judges, TOs, tournament organizers understand what is supposed to be the pace of the game and how that should affect the dials.
Exactly. As long as you're both at least tracking the game, because I know you can't write anything down. But honestly, right, you can have a cell phone there, and every time your opponent set your dials, you can just click the lap button. I don't think that clock timers on a table are a good idea. However, your phone can do it. So there's no reason why you can't do it. Your opponent might protest. I don't know what road this is going to make the game go down. Because, you know, if I see someone tracking my dials, I don't know how I'm going to react. But if I'm playing my game, there should be no reason that I should worry.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, you know, with all this that you did, you quantified something that I felt when I was going through it, because I didn't have any numbers. It just, I said that, you know, in the middle, edit that up, Dion. in the middle of the match, things slowed down. You got faster at the end because, like you said, ship was dead. Things were inevitable. Game ended. So first, thank you for doing all that work. It's awesome job of you, and thank you for giving this contribution to the community.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome. Like, and I can't stress enough that I'm only doing this because I absolutely love the game, and I don't personally feel that it's this big of an issue. However, I'm not at tons of tournaments like you guys are or other people are. From what I see on stream, I don't think represents what's actually happening totally at a tournament. Because slow play might be happening at the lower levels, but people aren't going to, you know, purposely slow play on a stream. But I'm at least watching these games and saying, okay, here's a definitive line of what a casual or at least a tournament game is supposed to run and how smooth it's supposed to be.
Right. And and one thing that you said is, you know, you were able to document 50 games.
Yep.
And in those 50 games, you found one instance of slow play.
Absolutely, yes. There was... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There was another instance to where I thought there was slow play, and even the person recording the match called for slow play, but it fell under that instance of they actually interviewed him after, and the guy said, I literally just didn't know what to do. There was no way I could win. And if I went back and reviewed it, and he was losing. No matter how slow he was playing, he might have been, like, you know, saying I was reserving MOV, but he purposely wasn't slow playing. But he didn't win the match either. So from a judge standpoint, you can easily say, well, he is playing slow, but he's not slow playing.
Right. Excellent. You know, I think that's a great spot to end it right there. This has been Patrick's dial average research, and we will get all of the data nicely packed for you. We'll put some links in the description. And Patrick, I'd like to have you on in the future as this continues to develop, and you know, you and I can keep taking a look at how this changes as the game grows.
Every turn you move a ship and then assign an action. Unless you overlap a ship or obstacle you pass. Of course, K4, a tiny expertise, you still get those. Cause that's the rules is written, that's how it goes. Some prefer a time before a combo win you a game, but there is no going back to the old days. The combos are crazy, they're here to stay. We need to come to peace with it, if not we'll go insane. We gotta play better, adapt, get good, attack, they all mean the same. Now ask yourself, what do you want on this tournament day? To fly your favorite chips or win with a meta? I feel your pain. To take the agency of every person that I play, to be the best or fly without a care? Let's put this debate to rest.
All right, so let's talk about our Chicago regional. We had the very first ever three-day regional. We had a day 1A, a day 1B, and a day 2. Ron, I think the plan is for next year just to start the format that way, isn't it?
Yeah. Plan for next year is we'll run the same format, day 1A, day 1 B, and then a day 2. And we'll know ahead of time so we can definitely much better plan how everything's going to go. And then we're going to set a smaller cap on each day so there's just more room in the store. So we don't have 100 plus people in the store in any one day.
There you go. So where I'd like to start first is I'd like to start with talking about maybe, you know, work. I think we're, as a group, we're proud of what we put forth, but there's always things we can improve. So let's talk about that first. So what are some things, Ron and Andrew, you guys ran the tournament side of it. What are some things that we're going to try to improve for next year?
Well, the first one we just briefly touched on, we'll announce everything early with a set plan. Everything that happened this year was kind of on the fly, with regional selling out on Saturday in 18 hours. We're like, whoa, 120 people sold out already. How do we open this up to more people so everyone can play? So we'll do that. I think the number one thing that everyone told me was they wish there was more space. I understand the concern for wanting to move the venue to an offsite location, but there's a lot of issues with that. If that is feasible and we could still give out prizes, maybe we'll try that. The biggest issue is, I mean, we looked at a venue. It was $2,500 to $5,000 for a weekend at a venue. We did not take in that much money all weekend. So you would basically get no prizes if we did something like that.
Right, just a kit.
Yeah, you would get a kit. It may be some swag that I have saved around the store. I gave away $1,500 in store credit.
Holy crap.
And I don't know how many thousands of dollars in prizes if you count the dollar value of like all the Miranda Donnie promos, all the Backstabber promos. I gave away 10 kits worth of random prizes. The backpacks, the playmats alone, we gave away 32 playmats. They're $40 a piece. I mean, do the math. Those backpacks pastimes would sell if they made something like that, or if I bought something, had a commission, they would sell for $60. So thousands and thousands of dollars of prizes were given away. So to put that in perspective, if we spent all that money on a venue, most of that would go away. So the biggest improvement is more space. The next improvement would be more organization going into the venue or into the structure of the events. Third improvement would be I did not do a good job running the redemption event, in my opinion. I think it could be massively improved upon. And if anyone wants to blame anyone, they could blame me. I had poor communication with Andrea. Sometimes when I do things, I forget, especially with her, that I know what I'm doing in my head. And if I don't explain it to her, like, it's on me. It's my fault. So I will fix that next year going forward. It will be a much better and more executed event, especially for how the prizes go out. The other thing that we will definitely do next year is I think we're going to add a team aspect to the regional format. So it won't be like it won't be like a separate event or anything, but it'll be a bonus to signing up as a team in addition to an as an individual. So I think that'll be a really fun thing next year.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to just to kind of get the whole, you know, we started with the quote unquote bad news first, but compared to what we did, we put on, we put on an amazing event. We had how many players did we have there?
159 was the official total of people that actually showed up. We ended up having 27, I think, no shows and drops total. You know, stuff comes up at the last minute, that kind of a thing. So yeah, 159 people. That's just the main event. We had 70 people in the redemption event. We had the top 32 going on at the same time. We had the warm-up event on Thursday. I think there was, 15, 16? There wasn't a ton. I thought there'd be a lot more. But again, we'll do a better job of promoting that and letting everyone know what the prizes are going to be. I mean, we also, I don't know of another event either. I mean, I think the prizes were good. I mean,
oh, the prizes were amazing.
The prize support was incredible, Ron.
So, I mean, I feel like it was worth it for people to come for the multi-weekend event.
Yeah, one thing that I'm seeing online a lot is those Thrawn backpacks. People are showing those off, and people are salivating over those.
I know. And I was trying to explain to people that they were going to be really cool. I wish I had one before the event started, like a month before the event started, so I could show people how cool they were. I think it would have just got more and more people excited about it. I knew they were going to be amazing. It just, you know, I had to order these things and I had to get them shipped overseas basically. And it was a massive thing to get those backpacks. It was not easy.
Well, we got it done. When it came to prizes, people were happy. Everybody left home with something. And like you said, I mean, a ridiculous $1,500 in store credit. That's a lot of store credit.
$1,500 in store credit to buy whatever you wanted to buy. You didn't even have to spend it that day. It's like cash. You could just hold on to it, spend it whenever you wanted. I mean, I'm the thing I'm most proud about is like last place that the guy that stayed all the way to the very end, the guy walked away with at the bare minimum 6 promo cards. But that's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a lot better than some of the other regionals, like that basically just have what they have in the kit, and that was it. If like you weren't in the top 64 or whatever it was just good luck.
Yeah, and honestly, we charged, I think, a very minimum fee. You paid $25 for 2 full days of, really 3 full days of X-Wing for some people, 2 full days for others. The other thing was we gave out prizes for like the bubble players. So the ones who were 17, 18, 19, and 20 on each day, those players got the shield tokens from the first FFG kits. So at least when you, and there was 2 guys that missed the cut by 1 MOV. So at least they got something cool.
Yeah, I mean, lots of prizes. I know that from going to other regionals and tournaments, the percentage, I mean, we put 100% of that money that came in from the registration to work for this event. It paid for all the promos, all the prizes. And I think it really shows, Ron, and that's why you are known as the Swag King.
Yeah, I was delirious during the tournament and accidentally called myself the Swag Queen too at one point.
It was hilarious. Jeremy Tran and I heard it and just instantly reacted and had a grand old time. That was our inside joke the whole weekend.
As the Swag Queen. You know, I also think we did, I want to say thanks, especially to like all you guys that helped. Mike Juris, my hero, helped coming out and judge. I think, I mean, between me and Mike and whoever, Andrea or whoever would help out, I mean, we handled judge calls for huge fields all day long, and it was just the two of us for the most part. I didn't really hear any arguments other than the the Genius Trajectory Simulator thing that really was brought up before the tournament. We just ruled you couldn't use it. I do apologize if someone was offended by that or they don't think I was right. I don't even know if I was right. It was just a decision that was made before the tournament because, honestly, whenever a new product comes out, we as TOs are left with that burden to kind of play the rules lawyer and decipher what is how these cards are supposed to interact and work. And honestly, we don't 100% know until FFG says something about that. So I would always ask that the community lean more on asking FFG to put out something before a major season like regionals or nationals than lean on your TOs who are volunteers and who do this for the community and don't really get on them if they make a call that you don't really agree with. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And on top of that, we made that decision for day one. And there was a couple people who came in day two and just, you know, they tried to beg the point again. But even after that, once, especially for a tournament like this, it's multi-day. Once you start with a ruling on the first day, it's best just to keep it consistent, because then if you start flip-flopping in the middle of the tournament, you start getting all those. But what if I had played on this day and had that ruling? You keep it consistent for the whole event and you just reevaluate for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think we did the right thing. We put out a document before the event. I answered anyone who emailed me a question, and I honestly told them what we were going to do ahead of time. So there was no misconception. It wasn't like I was trying to hide or do something shady. Anyone that thinks that I got rid of the rule because I personally don't like the ability because I got beat by it. That's not true. I lose at X-Wing, you know, and it doesn't really faze me because I spend 90% of my time teaching people how to play X-Wing than actually playing X-Wing myself. So most of the time I'm losing on purpose.
But yeah, we put on a great event. And now what I want to do is, Andrea, real quick. I know that your voice, just like mine, we could kind of coming in and out, but I want to say thank you for all that you did. You stayed at the command center. I know I pinned you in with the streaming table.
Yeah, I got in a lot of extra steps trying to navigate around that little trap.
But you did a great job of managing all those slips, and even after telling people to double and triple check their slips, you caught people's mistakes and said, "Are you sure?"
Yeah, there's a lot less this year. I will thank all of our players for really, and maybe it was our announcements, the way that we phrased it, but there was only maybe, you know, 10 the whole weekend as opposed to probably like 40.
that's a good improvement.
Yeah, and I gotta say thank you to my wife publicly, because I don't think anyone really realizes how important she is to this event. I mean, she runs everything at that computer. I mean, from getting the pairings, everything that goes on from, you know, a tournament support, whatever you want to call it, that's all Andrea. All I do is walk around and answer questions for people as my name gets called. She does all the hard, heavy lifting and probably doesn't get nowhere near the recognition that she deserves.
Woo, go Andrea.
Yeah, right?
Excellent. So I want to move now into the meta talk.
Wait, okay, hold on. Hold on. Oh. We got to thank you, dude. We have to thank you for coming all weekend long, setting up the stream early, staying late, taking down the stream, managing all the deck lists, getting all the information out, the social media. I didn't do any of the social media. You did it all. You did all the streaming. You made sure that everybody can watch their matches. There was no technical issues. I mean, dude, you nailed it. I mean, so many people got to watch that stream. because of you, and that is a huge amount of work for one person. So I want to say thank you to you, because without it, I mean, it's only half of an event if only 150 people can see it.
It was a lot of work. I do have to say thank you to Johnny. He was able to commentate day one while I was playing. There was some issues during the event, so I had to run to the streaming table a couple times. But and thank you to Zach Matthews for helping me out. I know there was a couple other people who jumped on with Johnny on that day one. So thank you to you guys. But you know, I really have a passion for the whole streaming thing, which is why I'm just trying to improve it every single time. I think this has been our best stream yet, and everything's available on YouTube right now to watch. It's available currently in long form. I've uploaded, I think, 3 matches, the final top 4 and top 8 as individual matches, and I'll keep chopping those. It just takes time because I have to import them, cut them, export, upload through the internet. It just takes some time to do, but everything's there and ready to go. We'll talk more about that, but thanks. I'm glad that I can do this for us. You know, I'm biased, so I think that we run the best regional, and I want to continue making sure that we have the best streaming to go along with it, and just keep that going hand in hand.
We're a great team.
Yeah.
Gold squadron.
That's right. Assemble.
We need rings or something.
It was pretty cool to be watching. I was watching it at work at my lunch hour, and my boss is like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm not even going to explain."
I don't know, but it looks really good.
He was like, "How do you get the dice on there like that?" That's what he said.
Yeah,
it was like magic.
Yep.
Dion Voodoo.
So, Dion Voodoo, exactly. So let's talk about the meta. Myself, Nate, and Marcel, we all played. We'll start with Nate. So Nate, what did you fly?
I flew my what I like to call now my classic Ray Miranda build, where it's Ray with expertise, Kanan, Finn, Smuggling Compartment, Burnout Slam, and the Swoop title. Miranda has TLT, Sabine, Bomblet, and Long Range. So I'm at 99 points. And this is the one that I used at Gen Con. I used it in a Canadian National, so it's taken me pretty far. It's still powerful. I think I have some trouble dealing with harpoon missiles sometimes and try to shrug off that damage.
What was your record? Where'd you end?
I ended up being 4-2. I did won the first one, lost the second one, won the other ones. I actually lost my sixth game. My second loss was against Jeremy Trad, who just trounced me. I tend to do very bad against Ghostless for some reason. Just I'm not good at handling them. I'm not good at like approaching them sometimes. But he just tabled me, and he was just really, really good at map control. He basically explained to me, like, "Hey, all I do is go back and forth, and then when you come to me, you're playing my game." And that's exactly how he did it. I had to approach him on his terms, and he just got me. There's nothing I can do.
Yep. But that 4-2 record did get you into the top 32, right?
It did. I was 14th for day one. I had just good enough MOV to slip in there, so...
And then how'd you end?
Oh, in the top 32, I went against... Oh, I forgot the guy's name. He was a nice guy. He played 2 Kimojilas, like the 2 named guys, like PS like 10 and 11 with Thweek. And I thought I played that very, very, very well. And I thought I had really great maneuvers, but just odds weren't in my favor on that one. And I just ended up getting unlucky. So I think he played well. I think I played well. I didn't think I made any mistakes in the last round, but just, man, I couldn't keep it together.
Marcel, what did you fly?
I flew 3K fighters. I flew Talon Bane, Victor Hell, and Justero.
And how did it go out for you?
Mediocre. I went 3-3. The wins, I didn't lose a ship at all when I won. And when I lost, they were pretty close. I think I lost one where Vessery was still alive with two hull, and the other two, it was a triple defender with three crack shot defenders. So I killed two defenders, got the other one to two or three health left, and couldn't finish Vessery off. The other loss was against Dash Miranda. Killed Dash. Miranda was left with zero shields, one hull, and pilot skill zero, critical, but couldn't put that last damage on her. And she's even at pilot skill zero, it's just hard to catch up to her. And the third one, I forgot, I lost. Oh, actually, the third one, I lost to Al. And that was just a silly maneuver. I accidentally put the wrong direction on my dial and flew Talonbane in the opposite way.
Oh, no.
So it happens. So I had two ships against his whole fleet. I had my two low pilot skill ships against his whole fleet with Talonbane facing the opposite direction. Not smart. So I ended up 3-3. And because of the games were, even that one was pretty close. So I think my MOV was towards the top of the 3-3s, but obviously 3-3 is not good enough.
So, you know, I know when we had been talking before the event, you know, you love to bring different types of lists. You like to bring your own homebrews. You had minimal practice with this list coming into it. How did it perform compared to what maybe you were expecting?
It performed almost exactly the way that I expected it to perform, which is kind of it either, because of all the damage output, it will completely annihilate something. But once you get past that, once you get around them, I don't have repositioning on those ships, and it's just just kind of a field day for most other lists can just eat through it. So it's kind of a one and done. You line up and you go for the kill. And if you don't get as much damage as you should, or if you don't take enough ships off the board in the first pass, then it's an uphill climb.
Why did you switch from, because me and you played this list a couple times and everything with each other. Mm-hmm. Why did you switch from Akima Gila to another, what'd you do? Did you switch to Victor Hell or?
Yeah, I switched from Dallin, the Dallin Kimajula to Victor
Hell.
How'd
you make that switch?
And it's just because Dallin dies too fast. It's just basically a B-wing. And the Victor Hell, just giving out stress and three agility, actually kept him alive long. I think if it wasn't for Victor Hell, those other games that I lost, I would have lost a lot worse. The only reason I didn't lose that bad is because Victor Hell stayed alive for a long time. And usually Victor Hell was the one that was the MVP dishing out stress and doing other things. So, I mean, it's not a bad list. I think you just need somebody who has better, for those of people that follow the podcast for a while, you guys know that I tend to do best with ships that reposition and ships that are not necessarily static, and this is the K-fighters are completely static with bad dials. So somebody who's good at flying, like any of the rebel list with bigs and things like that, would probably do really well with this, because you have a better eye for it than me, that I like to go fast and jump around and block and do those kind of things that these ships can't do.
Awesome. So for myself, I flew Kylo Ren with Push to Limit, Advanced Optics, Auto Thrusters, the Tidal, and Advanced Sensors, with two Alpha Class Star Wings. They had Adaptability, Harpoon Missiles, and Long Range Scanners. I ended 4-2 on day 1A. I was the top 4-2. I was the 10 seed going into day 2. I felt really good flying my list. My two losses on day 1A, I lost to Jeremy Trad too. So it was a close game though. I think the score was 72-50. It was something in that range. That list is a beast though. I was playing it well. It was one of those where I just didn't have enough time to get it done, because with my list, I had to just be really careful, because those four TLTs just tear apart even Kylo and the gunboats. It's just, it can be bad really, really fast. And then I also lost to Nate, and I keep replaying this game in my head. And I think about that last turn, Nate, and I realize what I did. I realize what I messed up.
What was that?
So in that game, I talked to my wife about it, and she gives me this look now, and she goes, you know, you shouldn't have done that. Like, I know. I took a gamble when I had a safe option there. So originally, let me set the scene. At this point, Miranda is PS0 because of a Kylo crit getting through, and she is behind me. She's come forward, and Rey is positioned in front of me, and I have a guess here. He's either going to come forward to block me or turn to the left to disengage, just kind of the way things were set up. Because he wouldn't want to block Miranda. At least that was my thought in that point. So I was like, okay, I can be greedy and say, all right, if he turns to what would have been his left and I turn to the right with a hard turn, I'll be at him range one and just murder Rey. And I might take a TLT shot from Miranda and I'll be fine. Or I could just five straight, get out and wait a couple turns and reposition and try to re-engage. That would have been the right decision. I didn't do that. So he goes in for the block with Rey. I got range one, Miranda spends a shield, annihilates Kylo, and that's the game.
I got lucky on that roll.
I mean, yeah, but I shouldn't have even been there. So that's my own bad there. And then, I did make the top 32, like I said, and I played against Kyle Adams, great player, local Illinois player.
I've never beaten that guy.
And our game was really, really close. It came down to the very last turn. But early, I am not one to complain about dice. I hate complaining about dice, but I'm going to take my opportunity now to do it.
Oh, please stand on that soapbox. Like what okay. happened was just terrible. It was brutal.
So I had two turns in a row, a range one shot on dash, and blanked out with target lock and focus. Did nothing. Didn't even do a shield. At the end of the game, the ending game state, I had one gunboat alive and Kylo alive, and Dash has one shield left. And if I had even done one shield in those times and everything else still happened, I would have won the game because he would have been at half points. And the way the points work out, I win. But the ending maneuver, I was flipping back and forth between a four and five forward. And I did a four forward. And I was thinking, all right, I need a four forward. Dash was kind of behind a rock with Corrin covering. But I knew that with advanced sensors, I could scoot over and go forward either past a rock or on a rock. I thought the five forward would take me past Dash, so I couldn't shoot him. So I dialed in the four. The back edge of my base touches the rock, and I explode. And that was that game. It was the very last turn. It was super exciting. And I don't feel bad about it because we both played really, really well. I mean, I wish I would have gone on, but great game, Kyle. So I'm coming for you next time, though. And let's talk about the field now, guys. We saw, I think, unarguably, the top faction at this regional was Rebels. Would you guys agree?
No doubt.
They're definitely the faction that rose to the top.
Yeah, I mean, I saw VCXs everywhere. The Ghost, I mean, it's been a popular ship for a long time, and it's just rising in popularity. You either saw VCX or Miranda on the table. Like, those were the lists. It was one of those combinations.
There was a lot of Wookiees, too.
I was going to say that there was a lot more than that. It was Wookiees, Lorik's mainly, and there was a lot of regen.
A lot of Poe.
What did Mike Jones say? He had Nora, didn't he? And Fen Rao. Fen Rao ended up being the thing that rose to the very, very top.
By no question.
Yeah. It was surprising how versatile that one little ship can just shut people down is the new mega leader.
And the other factions were 100% represented. There was a ton of Imperials. There was, I would say, more Imperials than Scum. I just think that there was really two strategies going into this event, it seemed like. And it was the ones who were using Harpoon and the ones that were going for defense to try to combat that. So I thought it was actually a really interesting and exciting metagame for this tournament. I didn't play a ton of games. I actually did play a game of X-Wing at the warm-up event, and it was against the eventual champion. But that was really fun. But I did watch a ton of X-Wing, so I got to see a lot of really cool stuff.
I think it was great because I haven't seen a meta like this at a regional since we did the Dice Dojo. The first time I actually met Ron, and when he kept on broadcasting, hey, come to Pastimes. It's this new store. It's this great place. We have a great community. You should come hang out with us. And it was at that regional, right, when it was before Dash Rendar came out, but when Cornhorn and the Defenders and everything out was great, was that every table had something different and interesting. Like back then, just everything, you'd be like, wow, that looks good. Oh, that looks fun. Here, I saw that same thing. Every table had something kind of, you know, a little twist, something, just so much creativity. And it was great to see that again. It just, the meta has really been blown open. It wasn't like before where it's like, oh, triple boats or just rack and, you know, ace or just all these staples. Everything is just open wide and it's really interesting. Everything is somewhat viable just as long as you play it well.
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of diversity at the top of the metagame. Like all the best stuff, there's a lot of diversity between that. So even like they were saying earlier with people, a lot of rebels, there were still six or seven or even more rebel ships that were ever present. It wasn't a carbon copy of any one list.
Yeah, you had the two Pilot Skill 3 Falcons running around beating people up.
If that guy didn't have to play my buddy, I was so rooting for him at one point because I was like, I would wanting to build a double resistance sympathizers list for so long.
I heard about the list.
I can't believe how good it was.
Yeah, so that list, that was Bob Howe, and I think from the top 32 list is the most surprising list. So it was two resistance sympathizers. One of them has Gunner and Rey. The other has the Millennium Falcon title and C-3PO and Gunner, and they both have engine upgrade. And we did get a game of him on the stream, and his strategy, what it looked like is he presents you first with the Rey Gunner, the one that's a little bit easier to kill, and then he kind of screens. Once he starts getting a little bit like shields off, maybe a damage card or two, he screens in the other one that is more defensive, and people were falling for it. Like people were having to shoot the C-3PO one because he would just get out of town. The Falcon dial is really good, plus engine upgrade. Just got out of town, and he surprised people. There were people who played against double Falcons who never played against double Falcons when it was a thing in the earlier waves. It caught a lot of people off guard. He went, I think he was 6-0 on the first day or 5-1.
He was 6-0. He went undefeated and played Leander Smith in the first round of the cut, who was one of the lower seeds.
Yep. And Leander has an advantage against that list because the TLT gets multiple rerolls and he can only use C-3PO once. That is the big thing that that gave Leander an up in that matchup. But yeah, I mean, there was a lot of different lists. We do have a list juggler going right now for both day 1A, day 1B, and day 2. So if you played, let's get them in there. We do have all the lists, and I mean, we could input them ourselves, but it's faster. You know, many hands makes light work.
I wanted to ask a question about that. Maybe someone can post it on our podcast page.
Mm-hmm.
As the TO, is there a way for me to, like, when that information comes, is there a way, like, even with the cryo decks where I can load all that stuff up or something?
Yeah, so I will tell you, if we used Cryo Dex as
we could have used it as well. We could have ran both systems to upload the info. I just didn't know how to do it.
Yeah, right at the end, it spits out a file that you, I mean, you could even just give it to me and I could do it. You just upload it. And what it does is it at least puts all the names in there. And it also gives you all the matchups. So once people put...
But you still have to enter the list.
You do still have to enter the list, but the names are honestly half the battle, because even people with the they won't, if they don't reference the sheet, it's hard to find themselves. And what the extra thing that Cryodex does is it shows you the matchups for each like in the cut, which is really cool.
Sure. Yeah. Well, now that now that we're gonna have some time, Andrea can. Well, before we didn't have a computer at Pastimes that would work and run the Cryodex. So we
Chico can verify. I asked him to try and help us with it one time, and like the save file wouldn't actually save. And when that terrible computer ended up crashing at some point, which was a guarantee I'd lose my whole tournament, it was the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and Andrea hadn't really been to the store that much, so she wasn't going to like, okay, I'm going to run. She didn't feel comfortable running a tournament off the Cryodex now that we could, since she had never used it, really. So she just wanted to use what was familiar, which is fine. But I think next year we definitely run the Cryodex.
Commercial.
Did you hear that, Chico?
Cryodex. All right. So I want to talk about the winner. We know the winner quite well, don't we, Ron?
Yeah, he's some scummy guy from Ohio.
He was sleeping on our couch the last three nights.
Actually, he's one of my best friends. Could not be a nicer person. His name is Mike Jones. He used to live here. We used to work together, but his family's in Ohio, so he moved to be closer to family. I can't really blame him. But he was one of the original Gold Squadron members, really helped me kind of grow the community, and we started playing X-Wing from the beginning together, and we would stay up all night. We'd drink like two cases of beer and play X-Wing so that we could eventually get better than Andrea.
Dang straight.
Yeah, because she used to beat us all. In the beginning of X-Wing, when it was just like wave two, like Andrea would wreck me and Mike. Like she was just naturally much better at the game. And then, like you guys, we kind of got obsessed with it. So, like, reading any articles, breaking down, doing math, figuring out the templates, and then we would practice all night because we worked serving jobs and we could sleep till 11, and Andrew would get up at, like, 6 and go to work. So, yeah, it was a very unfair advantage. But Mike's a good guy, and he came all the way from Ohio to play in this tournament. And he had a great list. If people don't know what his list was, I'm sure you have it specifically if you want to go over it.
I do. So his list was Poe Dameron with black one title, R5P9, that is the droid where you spend a focus at the end of combat to add a shield, auto thrusters, adaptability to, he was at PS8, so this gets him to PS9. And advanced optics, that's the tech card that lets you keep a focus token permanently. You can only have one focus at a time. Then you had Nora Wexley with push the limit. That's two actions for a stress a turn. C-3PO, adding some extra defense. R2-D2, you get extra shields, or not extra shields, but you regen shields on green maneuvers. The Alliance overhaul title and vector thrusters, which adds barrel roll to the action bar of the ARC-170, and a Fen Rao Sheathipede with just adaptability, getting it also up to PS9. The construction of the list is great. I highly suggest that you watch that last game on YouTube, because it swung back and forth between the two players throughout the entire match. And, you know, at one point, we were convinced that Jeremy was going to win. We were like, oh, wait, but maybe Mike has an advantage here. And just, yeah, man, it went back and forth. And Mike was able to win the day at the end. It was a really exciting match.
Yeah, and it's funny. And he was texting me, you know, before the match or before the weekend started, you know, as early as Monday and Tuesday. It's like, Ron, and that was the list he texted. He's like, I've been kind of working on this thing. I think that this is one I'm going to play. He's like, but I really want your advice on what I should do. And I was like, Mike, you should just play that list. It looks really good. And if that's what you've been practicing, go for it. I didn't even suggest any changes. It was all him. He played well. I was very, very, very happy to see him play fast when he needed to play fast, and I didn't see any mistakes really. But my eye isn't as attuned as others. So, but he played good enough to win, and that's what mattered.
One thing about Mike Jones and when it comes to Rebel Regen is that you have to be patient and understand that because you do have the tool of Rebel Regen, you have to make sure that you use it. Some people get a little bit desperate and they'll start doing white maneuvers. And he was able to find ways to leverage the barrel roll. The barrel roll, the vectored thrusters, was huge on Nora because without it, I think he loses that game.
He wrecked me with that vector thruster when we played, and I watched him use that in perfection multiple times. I was really shocked. Honestly, Mike got me excited to play X-Wing in a competitive sense with an ARC 170.
Yeah, I mean it's a great list. But he was able to. So it was a Jeremy Trad. He had a ghost list. We should probably go through that list because there actually is something really cool in there.
Super cool.
So Jeremy's list has Kanan Jarrus, which is the focal point of the piece here, with Sensor Jammer, which says you turn one of your incoming hits to a focus from an enemy. You got Twin Laser Turret, the Ray Crew card, the Ghost title, and the Maul Crew card. Yes, the Maul Crew card. Then we also have the Ezra Bridger Attack Shuttle. It was docked in the Ghost. It had Selflessness and the Phantom title. And alongside it, it had a Sheathapede Fen Rao with Veteran Instincts, bringing it up to Pilot Skill 11. Flight Assist Astromech and Hot Shot Co-pilot. The interaction here, you know, one of the things that we talked about when Maul was released, it says, I had said, or maybe it was Marcel, that somebody was going to find a spot for this card to work and leverage its ability. We just haven't seen it yet. And I think as of right now, this is the best use of it I've seen. So understanding the way the attack, the perform attack flowchart works is the beauty of Maul. So the Twin Laser Turret is a single attack. So you can, let's say you throw your dice on your first TLT volley and it hits, right? On the second one, you basically get a free reroll with Maul. And it doesn't matter whether the second part of that TLT hits because the entire attack hit. So that last stress comes off anyway. And that is one of the key pieces of the list, because you can do that on both the first TLT that happens and also the end of round. So you're getting essentially target lock focus with Ray on as many shots as you need. And then leveraging the Fen Rao attack shuttle to use Hotshot Copilot, take away other people's modification, and then have these super modified attacks coming at you. It was brutal. I mean, both Nate and I saw it in action, and it was tough to play against.
It was.
As a judge, I saw that, and I was watching, and I saw him do the Maul interaction off the TLT and remove the stress, and I was like, in my mind, I'm like, wait a minute, how does that work? So like, I quickly ran over and like started looking up some things, and I'm like, just like you, when I saw the flowchart, I was like, wow, that is bloody genius. I didn't even consider that. And me and Mike were talking about it, and Mike Juris, and was like, wow, Maul on that ship is really smart. Whoever thought of that, kudos to them, because I honestly didn't see that.
So the creator of that list is Alex Mogensen. He's in the playgroup with Jeremy Trad, Zach Matthews, and Nathan Eide. They're up in Wisconsin, and he is actually the creator of the list. He was commentating with me on that last game, and he gives a lot of insight onto the reasons why they made those the decisions in list building and some strategy that goes along with playing it.
Yeah, I got to play Alex during the Redemption Tournament. I was playing something a little bit silly. I was playing a Pilot Skill 11 Dengar with Hotshot Copilot and Tweak with, with Sensor Jammer. So basically the idea there is to Hotshot Copilot something to just reduce the incoming damage and let Tweak just get in people's faces. And I flew against his list. And yeah, it's pretty interesting. Unfortunately for him, he ended up winning because I flew over a rock and blew myself up. But one of the weaknesses to that list is once Fenrau drops, Cannon is kind of out there on his own, and the Sensor Jammer and all of that for something that has like the Hotshot Copilot being able to strip multiple focuses because they're not using recon spec to basically get unlimited focuses. You can eat through their focus stack pretty quickly, and if you can kill Fen, which is not that tanky, then you have good matchup. I don't know. Jeremy lost one on day one, right?
Yeah, he did.
I think
day one 5-1.
Yeah, but I was looking at it as far as like the list that I brought with the 3K fighters. My list would have been completely annihilated because it completely shuts down everything that I'm trying to do, putting damage out. So that list requires something special to beat it. You need a specific counter for it, whether it's Hotshot Copilot yourself or your own Fenrau. I think that's probably why Mike Jones was able to do what he did, because again, that Fenrau ship being able to completely shut down the modifiers on a ship is insane.
Yeah, like Neil Leander talked about that because he had his ghost build as well, and he said that he didn't even know what Fenrau did, and then he realized, oh my god, this is completely shutting me down, one little ship, because unfortunately the ghost, all the damage comes out of one ship, and as long as Fenrau is there to shut down that one ship, it just really wrecks like the ability to push through damage that it usually has.
One of the weaknesses of this list, of Jeremy's list, is modifications that are not tokens. So Predator, Expertise is probably the biggest one. Expertise list can tear through this pretty quickly because it doesn't care about focus.
Yeah, that was my list, was Expertise list, and I had to fly it on his terms. Otherwise, my Expertise just didn't work.
Your issue there is that you had 2-1 agility ships versus this like crazy TLT. But
yeah,
but it was a great match. Again, I highly suggest taking a look at it. Well flown. You actually get to see Mike also play, I believe it's the top 4 game. He had another really solid game there, and seeing how the championship list was able to fly in multiple games, gets to see it in different game situations. Lastly, if you were at the regional, like we had said already, we made a list juggler entry for it. So please go on there and enter your list. I actually made a video tutorial on how to put that in there, because there's a couple people who were asking me the same question. So I did a minute and 30 seconds on how to enter your name and enter your list. It has all the links in there. Go to our Facebook page. It's there. One mistake I did notice that is popping up, because I think it's a squad builder issue right now, is for instance, Alex Mogensen's list is coming up as 108 points, but it's not. What's happening is that it's taking the squad builder is putting in the point cost for the scum Fenrau instead of the rebel Fenrau, which is 8 points more expensive. So just be cognizant of that. I started seeing some bubbling up of like, wait, did he have an illegal list or something? No, he didn't. It's a squad builder error. So take a look at that.
Do you live in the Chicagoland area or plan on visiting? Come on down to Pastimes Comics and Games, the home of Ghoul Squadron, where we play X-Wing every Wednesday and have tournaments the first Sunday of every month. We also play Imperial Assault, Armada, LCG, and Destiny on different days. Visit our Facebook page, Pastimes Star Wars, for more information.
So I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight, and thank you for listening. You can watch our replay of the X-Wing stream that we just did on our YouTube channel, and you can catch live streams of our content at twitch.tv/GoldSquadronPodcast. We're doing a bunch of regionals and system opens. Our next one is coming up this upcoming weekend. I will be flying down to San Antonio, Texas to bring you live coverage, as long as the internet holds up, hopefully. Live coverage, if not recorded coverage, of the system open there. You can go to xwingpodcasts.com to see content from all your favorite X-Wing podcasts all in one spot. And lastly, if you enjoyed the show, you like the stream, and you want to help continue expanding our content, there's something new you can do. Okay. And it actually, for some of you, will cost you $0. So if you have Amazon Prime, I know a lot of people have Amazon Prime because who doesn't like free 2-day shipping, right? And all the other things that come with it. One of the things you actually have, Amazon owns Twitch. If you connect your Amazon Prime account to Twitch and you become a Prime subscriber for 1 month, it's just clicking a button. It's a $5.99 value of a subscription. But what happens is that it throws $2 my way just by clicking that button. And it's part of your Amazon Prime subscription. Like, it doesn't actually cost you any money. You just click the button, and you can click that button once a month. So if you have Amazon Prime, do that. If you want help, I'm actually going to end up putting a video and showing how to do it. It's a couple steps to link the accounts, but after that, it's just a one button click. And you can also go to patreon.com/goldsquadron, get swag, help out the show. Thank you so much to the patrons. I mean, all the equipment, Ron saw it. I mean, he saw the full load of everything. I brought everything out of all the different equipment and wires and adapters and all these things to make it work. I mean, it's a lot of stuff, and thank you guys so much for, because otherwise we would still be using our little webcam on a PVC pipe.
I really wish we took a picture of that sham of a setup that we started from, and then a picture of everything that you were able to purchase because of the Patreon, and showing how technically like advanced the stream has become because of all the patrons. I mean, I don't think anyone can fully appreciate it. I mean, we had a sham of a thing which turned into this high quality broadcast that you put together. And
I was thinking about that hilarious cool, PVC pipe with the zip ties cameras.
We've come a long way.
Yep. Next year, I will say, for the regional, I'm getting a speaker and a microphone. I don't know how it's going to happen, by hook or crook. Alan, I'm coming to you for some dollars for a speaker and a microphone.
I was joking, but not joking, that about how sure. I felt like I just needed to have a rape whistle to get everybody's attention in there by the time the weekend was over.
For Marcel, Nate, Ron, and Andrea, my name is Dio Morales. We are Gold Squadron. Gold Squadron out.